Matthew, thanks so much. It's a terrific honor to be with you this morning. And I'm really encouraged that there are so many here who want to think about what it looks like to reach and engage and release Gen Z. I'm going to call it Gen Z because if you speak to anybody who falls into the category of Gen Z, that's how they'll pronounce it, not Gen Z. So, you know, don't think that this is cultural imperialism or saying anything about it on that part, apart from using the lingo that we have been given. Today we're going to think about what it looks like to engage Gen Z in two of their characteristics. One is in their diversity. They think of themselves as a very diverse generation, and in many ways they are a very diverse generation. And we're going to just scratch the surface of what it looks like to engage a generation that perhaps is the first truly digital native generation. Tomorrow, we'll think more about how Gen Z approach issues around the body and health. This was something really I'd not thought about until I started engaging this issue a couple of years ago. And then some of you will be here because you're thinking, I need to understand what's going on in this so-called quiet revival. We will get there, but that will be in the second half of tomorrow. Today, though, I think will help you understand some of the undercurrents that perhaps lies behind some of those phenomena. I've had the great privilege over the past 8 months or so to travel to a number of countries to meet members of Gen Z around the world. It's been a terrific honor, actually, working with the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students. I'm not really going to touch on the international dimensions of what we're speaking about today, more taking kind of C.S. Lewis's adage, the more you travel, the more you understand home. I think probably actually placing some of the trends that are happening globally will help us to understand perhaps what's happening within the UK a little more as well. Let me start very briefly by introducing generational theory and introducing Gen Z. For some of you, perhaps this is the bit where you can just take a nap for 2 minutes if you didn't sleep very well tonight. But here's what I want to say about generational theory, and it's this. The generational theory is primarily concerns where a group sets their calibration points. Okay, and that is the way that we're going to think about this issue today and tomorrow. This generation today and tomorrow. The reason I say this is because if you're not of Gen Z, in fact, oh no, we'll come to who here is and isn't in a moment. If you're not of Gen Z, you can be kind of quite curmudgeonly. I've noticed this is true even within the church when it comes to describing emerging generations. And, you know, you look back even to the classics and people were whinging about the youth of today. That's not what we're about, okay? We're also not going to think about stereotypes or trends. So if you Google Gen Z at the moment, we'll talk about a whole amount of kind of music which is being released at the moment, which is ostensibly Gen Z. And that may or may not be a good connection. But the truth is, probably in 5-10 years, people will have forgotten all of those artists and trends will have moved on. Instead, what generational theory says, which I think is truly helpful, is that you calibrate what you consider to be normal in your childhood and your adolescence and your early adulthood. In other words, what happens to you between ages 0 to 20 sets what you consider to be normal and the default for the whole of the rest of your life. Doesn't mean that you can't learn things, it doesn't mean that you don't change your opinions on things, but you nearly always compare them to that default that was set, normally within your teenage years. And the way that I can prove this to you is if I ask you when you think the zenith of popular music was. Now, I almost guarantee, and I'm the same, 1997, Blur versus Oasis, that was it. Okay? And now, for nearly all of us, the music that we were into when we were 15 or 16 years old is still what we compare all other music to. Doesn't mean that you can't appreciate other music that's come later, okay? But you set your default at that age. So when we talk about impressionable youth, sometimes we use that in quite a derogatory, they're just an impressionable youth. The truth is, you really are impressionable in your youth, in as much as it causes you to see the world and to set defaults, and even to want certain things in a certain way, that you'll compare everything that you experience later in life against those. Now, what generational theory says is that there are some big macro changes that take place in the world. Technological, financial, social, which broadly affect what people who are born at a similar time consider to be normal for a long period afterwards. Okay, so it's reckoned that there are 6 living generations today. The builders, sometimes they're called the greatest generation, who were born before the Second World War. Boomers, who were born between about 1946 and 1964. And you can see all the way through to Gen Z, who were born, this says between 1995 and 2009. I'm actually going to date it slightly differently. I date it between 1997 and 2012, and we can come on to that if we want to. And then Gen Alpha and Gen Beta, who were born afterwards. Now, I think this way of thinking about calibration is super important for 2 reasons. Firstly, it helps us to avoid clickbait stereotypes. Now, lots of surveys of Gen Z say that they feel pretty misunderstood by other generations. In the UK, around 60% of people within Gen Z say, I don't like the way that my generation is spoken about by everybody else. I would reckon, actually, that the statistic would be similar amongst Christians as well. Now, all generations stereotype each other, but it seems that this generation, Gen Z, is particularly liable to be stereotyped. Here are some real headlines from the past 2 years from British newspapers. Gen Z is developing hunchbacks from too much phone use, doctors say. Gen Z is texting each other from different rooms in the same house. This is bizarre, isn't it? Gen Z is refusing to learn cursive and killing the handwriting industry. And then perhaps this is my favorite. Millennials are killing napkins and Gen Z doesn't even know what they are. Now, we're not about clickbait stereotypes. We're not about clickbait stereotypes. Nor are we about thinking that we can tar everybody with the same brush. The tragedy will be if you go back to your home church and think, aha, Gen Z, I know you. Okay, that's not the case at all. We're going to talk about some big brushstrokes that affect how a generation see the world. But it would be tragic if we don't realize that there is a huge amount of diversity that is within that generation. Whenever you use any category to analyze anything, it brings certain things into sharper definition, but it obscures others. Okay, and so we're going to focus on the generational things that will help us to see certain issues, certain phenomena in sharper definition. But the truth is, you could slice and dice some of these issues in other ways, and you would see them in kind of complementary camera angles. So the fact that we're talking about generation today doesn't mean that perhaps issues around class or ethnicity or education or many of those other formative influences on us that shape how we see and engage with the world don't matter, okay? All that said, I want us to think about 2 characteristics of Gen Z today, which hopefully will help us to think about how we might reach those that we know who fall within that generation, disciple them, and perhaps serve those in our churches who are from this generation. The first issue that I want to think around is diversity. Now, it is undoubtedly true that, at least ethnically speaking, Gen Z are the most ethnically diverse generation in Britain in recorded history. My wife hates numbers. She's like, oh, you're not going to put a chart in, are you? I'm sorry for those who equally despise numbers. What I'd love you to do, just for 1 minute, perhaps on your tables or with the person next to you, is just notice things about these statistics. I've highlighted in yellow, these are the categories from the 2021 Census of England and Wales. Just what do you notice about the ethnic makeup of Gen Z compared to other generations in the UK? Let me give you just 2 minutes. What do you notice? No right and wrong answers here. I love the census. I think it's so useful to those of us in ministry. And you can look at this for a very long time. But clearly there is a general pattern that the percentage of those who are ethnically white is decreasing with time. And you can see there's a big jump up in those who are Asian, mainly South Asian heritage this is. And, you know, that generation is large amongst Gen Z. Did you notice that there is a slight decrease in the percentage of people who are black within the generation, but that's more than compensated for by those who are of mixed heritage? And that reflects some big social changes that took place in the UK about 20 years ago, or slightly longer ago, which meant that inter-ethnic marriage became much more welcomed within British culture. And so there's this interesting, this gives an interesting snapshot, I think, of a generation that certainly of the adult generations in the UK is the most diverse. Possibly that those who are under nine and who've been born since the census will be even more ethnically diverse again. But it seems as though, at least within conceptual thinking, ethnic diversity has reached something of a tipping point in people's minds amongst Gen Z. Gen Z make up 18% of all people in the UK, but get this, 40% of all Congolese and Somali people who live in the UK are Gen Z. Many of the rest of them actually would be younger than Gen Z. 39% of Ghanaians are Gen Z. 37% of Arabs, Moroccans, and Slovakians, 36% of Turkish people, 35% of Angolans, Ivorians, and Czechs, as well as those from mixed black heritage. So that might be perhaps one African parent, one parent from the Caribbean. 34% of Nigerians, Roma, British Pakistanis, and those with mixed black and Asian heritage. So all of these groups are overrepresented amongst Gen Z. Just for 10 seconds, in the quietness of your heart, I wonder how that makes you feel. The truth is, if the church is going to be strong in engaging the emerging generations, both young adults and teenagers, and beyond that, children, it is by nature going to have to be an intercultural ministry. Increasingly, your Sunday school ministry, your youth ministry, and your intercultural ministry are going to have to become one and the same thing. Because you'll have leaders of the groups that potentially are not of the same ethnic background as those that they're seeking to reach and disciple. And here is just one other nod. I know it's not an ethnic group, but 27% of all Muslims in the UK are Gen Z as well. Now, I'll try and show this a bit graphically. For those who prefer graphics rather than numbers, I'm sorry this is really small. So long as you can see the little figures, that's really enough. This is an average makeup of a high school class in Britain at different points. So in 1960, can you see, in the average British high school class, everybody was white. On average. And there was often one non-British person, and they were often Italian, Irish, or Polish, as a kind of residue of families who relocated after the Second World War. If you were at high school in 1980, there would be, on average, 27 white people in your class, two black people in your class, normally of Caribbean heritage, often related to those who came as part of the Windrush generation, and then one of South Asian heritage, perhaps from Bangladesh, India, or Pakistan. If you were at high school in 2000, there would have been 24 white people in your class on average, two black students, three of South Asian heritage, and one of mixed heritage. In 2020, 5 years ago, 18 white people in a class, three black, four of South Asian heritage, three mixed, and two from other ethnic backgrounds. And in London, this is at the bottom, London in 2020, there is no ethnic majority anymore. 13 white students, five black students, seven of South Asian heritage, three mixed, and two of different ethnic backgrounds. And so there is a quick and accelerating force of cultural and ethnic diversity amongst school-age people today. Now, what I would love you to talk about around your tables, and let's, if you're Gen Z, can you just put your hand up? This is not a case of shaming ye, okay? These are the experts, okay? So draw on their expertise. I want you to discuss this. Having grown up in an ethnically diverse environment, what things might seem normal to members of Gen Z that might not seem so obvious to older generations? Now, there are some obvious answers here, but try and push through the obvious ones first, get them out in the first few seconds, and then think what other things might seem normal to members of Gen Z that don't feel a kind of default in quite the same way to the rest of us. Yep, discuss that for just a few moments. So yeah, let's just draw out between us some of what we think might seem normal, or if you're from Gen Z, perhaps this is helping you to appreciate what seems normal to you that doesn't quite seem normal to those from other generations. Let's hear some of your ideas.
Something that I have experienced in sort of our youth, in my youth group, they've got a lot of Muslim friends, so they're quite swayed by that, and they do feel like it's arrogant to say that Christianity is the one true faith because they are quite influenced by their friends. Yeah.
Very helpful. So actually for some of the rest of us, we've had to wrestle through questions about religious pluralism, the uniqueness of Jesus in a world of religions. Actually, that you know that you ask that question slightly differently if those who hold other opinions have other faith convictions have got a face. And we'll think a bit more about the influence of Islam again tomorrow as well. Yeah.
We've wondered whether there's a difference between whether they're first or second generation Gen Zs.
There is. There is a big difference.
And if it's first generation, it might be slightly different because there might be different languages spoken in their yeah. household and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so there are some big differences between first and second generation immigrants. Again, we'll think about that a bit tomorrow. The truth is that there are both. So in the kind of Blair Brown, the end of the Labour government, there was a big group of immigrants who arrived at about that time who have just sort of ticked over into the Gen Z, who are just beginning to show in the statistics now, others who've been here for much longer. Absolutely, yeah.
We wondered if there might be increased kind of division between urban centres and more rural communities as well.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is everywhere is becoming more ethnically diverse. But the pace of change is certainly much more accelerated. And so it would also be fair to say, actually, that Gen Z are the most urban generation in British recent history as well. A higher percentage of Gen Z are living in urban areas than elsewhere. But absolutely, there is no default experience. Yeah.
I wonder if there's a difference in how Gen Z talk about race and discuss race a bit more openly and casually.
Absolutely.
I was part of a youth team running a youth group where the team were all white. I was Gen Z, but the rest were like the generation above me. And then the kids were pretty much all black. And they'd be like joking about race and saying things where they're like, oh, we're not sure how to like address this. We felt much more uncomfortable and worried about saying the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Whereas they would be like really open about their culture, but also like kind of jibing at each other about things like that as well.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. That there's a kind of intuitive ability to navigate ethnic and cultural difference amongst Gen Z in a way that feels a lot more natural to many people, particularly, again, those from urban areas, than those of older generations. Right, let's move on, because I want to describe some big shifts that I think this mindset around ethnic and cultural difference has brought elsewhere. Firstly, it means that when it comes to finding truth, Gen Z are quite sophisticated. It's very rare, I think, that you meet somebody who's a genuine relativist, who genuinely thinks that all truth claims are equal, that they're all the same. I think that's very rare, and I haven't met very many people who hold that. They are much more comfortable, though, in the idea that different truth claims are like different camera angles on reality, and that they can be complementary. And to some extent, even if they're contradictory, you can still say, from that angle, that makes sense. Okay? So, I remember an interview with a student in Dublin, and he was talking about an Irish-Pakistani person in his high school, and a Nigerian immigrant, and somebody who was trans. And he basically said, I think all of them are telling the truth in their experience in some ways. That there are things that you can only learn about family if you're Irish-Pakistani. And what he's saying about family is true and right. And there are other things about where life is really to be found that I could only learn through my Nigerian friend and through his life experience. And there are other things that my trans friend was saying, and all of those things are true at the same time. And you kind of say, yeah, but actually, if we put all of these on the table, there's a lot of contradiction between them. And yet, this Irish student said, no, but within their context, within their discourse, everything they're doing is truthful to them. And I need to hear that truth. And so this isn't a case of pure relativism. People aren't saying, they're not saying there is no truth. They are saying there is truth and there's truth to be found, but no one camera angle is going to give you all of the truth. And you need to have lots and lots of camera angles to get a better picture of truth. And the more camera angles you have on truth, the clearer you will perceive what's really there. Okay, now this is sophisticated, and this is probably as deeply philosophical as we're going to go today, but even Christian Gen Z, church Gen Z, will tend to talk about this. And therefore, they can sing a song, Jesus, you are the truth, and yet they still might think, but there perhaps is also truth in Islam, and there perhaps is also truth in manifesting, and there perhaps also is truth in horoscopes. Okay. So we've moved from this idea, this isn't pure relativism, but it is saying, and it sounds very humble actually, and in many ways it is humble to say, no one person has more than a slice of perspective on reality. Here's a second big shift. When it comes to pursuing justice, Gen Z much more intuitively prize equity over equality. Now, some of you will have seen this is a really popular internet meme. And if you talk to Gen Z about fairness, often they will allude to this, even if they don't mention it by name. So there's two pictures of what's fair. Can you see the picture on the left-hand side is of equality? Everybody gets the same. But because some were more naturally disadvantaged in the first place, it doesn't help them as much as it helps others. The right-hand picture is of equity, and it basically says justice is prizing not the same opportunities or the same resources, but the opportunity to have the same outcome. And this is much more where Gen Z will fall, okay? And the reason for that, again, is partly because they've rubbed shoulders with a much wider range of people on average than others did in their school age. They're aware of people in their class, perhaps, who have learning difficulties and therefore who've required more educational intervention in order to get the same outcome. They're aware that actually if English is not your first language, school is harder and you need more help in order to have the opportunity to get the same outcomes when it comes to exams. And so this is a second big shift, okay? That being around a wider range of people, Gen Z are more naturally aware of the disparity that exists within British society. And again, because they have first-hand experience of this, to them, actually simply going for equality is not enough. We have to pursue equity instead. Now, there is an interesting pushback to this. There's an interesting countercurrent, which we'll think about in just a moment. But I would say probably around 90% of Gen Z would hold this view of justice. Thirdly, when it comes to defining yourself, there's increasing complexity and individuality. Now, again, this is for a whole number of reasons which we can't get into very much more. But the fact that there is increased ethnic and cultural diversity, a growing number of mixed-raced people within British culture, means that a whole number of traditional labels that we would have held now just don't feel like they do the job anymore. And so, Gen Z increasingly, when they think about themselves, want to use longer and longer and longer labels to describe themselves. And you can see this when it comes not just to ethnic and cultural heritage, but in how they define their sexuality, how they define their neural function, whether they're neurodiverse or neurotypical, and in a whole number of other ways. Increasingly, people are thinking of themselves in individual forms, and the label that they can give may almost be unique to them. When it comes to thinking about how to be free, there's an interesting shift here as well. I wish that we could speak about this more, because this is something which I think is really important for the church to grasp. That we've moved away from protecting the rights of minority groups, which largely was achieved in the second half of the 20th century, to where Gen Z are. They're saying, it's not enough simply to have rights, I also need to feel at home. And those around me need to change in order to make me feel at home. The way that I'm going to illustrate this is the difference between two people writing about wearing the hijab in school. The first is from about 15 years ago. The other is much more recent. Here's the first of them. So this is the one from about 15 years ago. And this woman says, "This morning, as I was intricately pinning my school hijab around my head, I was thinking of how privileged I am to be able to wear my hijab to school. But it shouldn't be my privilege. It is my right. It shouldn't be something that women everywhere have to continue to fight for every day. I feel for my hijabi sisters around the world. What would I have to do if I had to choose between getting an education and wearing my hijab?" Now, do you see the language is around rights? I have a right to wear a hijab and to go to school and not to have to choose between my religion and my education. Now, this next one is from a 14-year-old in Australia from last year. Notice the difference. "I've experienced Islamophobic comments. Dress and look like a real Australian. And perhaps if these people could attempt to assimilate rather than try and impose on us what they allegedly fled from. These encounters are devastatingly the norm amongst my Muslim community, with many hijabis having experienced this hatred. I urge you, stand in solidarity with us to call out racist behavior and attacks on hijabis any way you see it. Do not turn a blind eye to Islamophobia, especially on innocent hijabi targets. Advocate for our rights on social media. Educate yourself about the hijab." Do you see the difference? The first person is saying, I have a right to wear a hijab. The second person is taking the right for granted. They're saying, I have a right to wear the hijab, but also not to feel othered by my classmates for wearing a hijab. And this is very much where the shift has taken place within Gen Z. It's not enough just to have rights that my parents and grandparents fought for. I also, if I'm going to be truly free, I need to feel affirmed and not to feel weird just for being me. This is a big shift. Now, I want to give one slight caveat to this, and that is something which the newspapers pick up on a lot, which is a countercurrent, which is that some Gen Z men are shifting to the right. And this does play into, I think, the Quiet Revival and some of the other things that we'll think about tomorrow. Now, you might notice, don't worry if you can't see all of the details that are in this chart. For each demographic, you can see how, first of all, women and men say that they would vote. Okay, so light blue is Reform, dark blue is Conservative. That's probably all you need to know, actually, at this point. Now, you can see the general trend that as the generations get younger, people are more likely to vote for left-wing parties. That is not a new phenomenon at all, okay? It is an established phenomenon that the older you get, the more conservative you tend to be, both in your outlook and your political allegiance. I know not everybody will hold this. I'm getting some daggers now. That is the general trend. Now, I want you to notice two things. Firstly, notice that the bottom two, which is 18 to 24-year-olds, are more likely to hold right-wing views or to vote, say that they would vote for right-wing parties than the generation that is above them, which is 25 to 34-year-olds. Okay, that's interesting, because already they're more right inclined than the generation above them. That's really unusual. The other thing, though, and this is especially unusual, is you might, so in this chart, it goes women, men, women, men, women, men, all the way down. The gap between women and men is particularly large between members of Gen Z. In other words, not only are Gen Z more likely to vote for right-leaning parties than the cohort that's above them, but men are much more likely, comparatively, to vote for parties of the right than the women of the same age. Now, you can overstate this, and this is why I put the chart up, because I think some papers, some commentators are really overstating this. It is a genuine trend, but we still need to keep it into perspective. I have noticed that when it comes to my interviews and focus groups, I would say around 1 in 6 Gen Z men holds much more conservative, right-leaning views than I would expect and I would have seen a few years ago. Around 1 in 6. Now, of that 1 in 6, quite a high proportion not only hold conservative views, but actually what would have probably been held as historically racist or misogynistic views. Now, we'll think about that a little bit more tomorrow when it comes to engaging people as they turn up at church, okay? This is an important countercurrent, just to notice. But what is true when it comes to ethnicity and cultural heritage is also largely seen, largely reflected when it comes to other things. Here is how Gen Z, relate to sexuality. The green bar is 100% of Gen Z. Now, go down to the bottom. Around 3% of Gen Z identify as gay or lesbian. Now, that is higher than others in the UK, but not substantially higher. Those identifying as lesbian, gay, or bisexual is around 10% of Gen Z. Now, that is substantially higher than other groups, and actually amongst women, it's around 13%. But get this. Those who say, I'm at least somewhat attracted to those of the same sex, it's around 40% of those within Gen Z, and those who say that they would be open to engaging in at least some forms of same-sex sexual behavior is around 60% of Gen Z. Now, I think this is fascinating. It shows that there is an uncoupling of identity, attraction, and behavior. But to Gen Z, that makes perfect sense. Okay? The fact that you may not identify as LGBTQ, and you may not even be attracted to those of the same sex, but that you would still be open, in the right circumstance, to engaging in same-sex sexual behavior is entirely plausible. And so I'm not going to say any more about this other than when Christians seem to be anti-diversity in any form, to most Gen Z, members of Gen Z, you're anti-diversity in every form. Okay? When Christians say things about sexuality but haven't proven themselves to be pro-human diversity in other ways, most members of Gen Z just assume you are anti all forms of diversity. You may be sexist, you're certainly homophobic and transphobic, and you may well be unwittingly racist as well. So, what does it look like to engage the diverse generation? Goodness, we need to speed up. The more Christians can celebrate God-given human diversity, the easier it is to push back on non-biblical understandings of human identity. I'd love you to think, just for 1 minute now, what could it look like for you to treasure and celebrate genuine God-given human diversity? And I'd like for you to start with small, non-tokenistic measures. And then I'd love you to think, where do you feel challenged in seeking to engage people from different ethnic or cultural identities to your own? Where do you need help? Just maybe 2 minutes around tables, and then we'll think about digital aspects. If you are from Gen Z and you think I've completely misrepresented you, feel free to say that to those around your table, particularly if you've not just misrepresented you, but let's say your cohort at university, your class at school, your work colleagues. I'd love you to particularly think about the first question. There'll be more time, actually, for thinking. If this all feels challenging today, tomorrow we'll think much more about the opportunity side of things. But I want us to think just for a few minutes before we finish on reaching the digital generation. Some people say 1995 is the year the future began. For this reason, that Amazon sold its first book in 1995. And this was considered to be a first major shift and moving forward with internet connection. So Google founded in 1996, Wikipedia 2001, Skype in 2003. There was then a second major shift with the arrival of early social media. MySpace 2003, remember that? Facebook 2004, Twitter 2006. There was another major move forward with hardware innovation with the invention of the iPhone in 2007, Android in 2008, which allowed WhatsApp, which so many of us now rely on, in 2010. And we reached quite a threshold moment in 2007 where 50% of UK homes had broadband. One of the ways, actually, in which you can work out whether or not you're Gen Z is, can you remember life before broadband? If you can, you're not Gen Z. Gen Z have only ever known broadband. Okay, now that is the default. That is the calibration point. And then, since then, there's been innovation of graphic-led platforms, partly because of broadband being so widely available. So YouTube, although it was launched back in 2005, really took off with broadband, Instagram 2010, Zoom 2011, Snapshot 2011, TikTok 2016. And if we were to do a fifth column, we could probably add something about AI as well. Okay? Now, all of these are technological forms that Gen Z have only ever known. They can't even remember. If you're Gen Z, you probably can't remember life before most of these things. Okay, now that's not bad and it's not wrong. That is the calibration point that Gen Z hold. What does this mean? It means that they tend to hold certain values. One is brevity. Okay? Samuel, my 12-year-old, tends to watch YouTube videos with the space bar held down so that he can watch everything at double speed. Okay? Often with subtitles on. Okay? Meaningless wasted seconds. I mean, this has affected all of us, hasn't it? I stood in at the post office queue last week, and I had to wait for like 2 minutes. I was like, oh, goodness, what do they think I'm doing? But actually, that's conditioned in a different way. if all you've ever known is being able to retrieve things very quickly. The second thing is personal choice, okay? So particularly when it comes to smartphones, the fact that you have one in your pocket, whether or not you realize it, is underlying your own sense of individuality. And the fact that you can start store what you want on your phone, and you can have your music there. The fact that actually watching TV together is largely now something that has died means that increasingly personal choice and the opportunity to choose is something which is much more intuitively inscribed into Gen Z's outlook. Speed, we've thought about that already, okay? The fact that my son can moan so quickly if the laptop takes 10 extra seconds to load up, okay, is something which to him, that matters. I can expect it to come tomorrow, or I can expect it to be delivered this afternoon. I'm not used to waiting. Participation is key. I guess it would have been during the lockdowns, a whole load of Christian unions wanted to welcome their freshers well, but couldn't do it in person. So a lot of it moved online. And there were concerns around security. What if actually somebody who's not a student tries to permeate some of these groups? And so a whole number of Christian unions switched their digital communications, particularly on WhatsApp, to only having the leaders comment and other people just listen. Now, what do you think happened? No one checked those groups. And you very quickly had splinter groups alongside, which would be called, I don't know, King's University Christian Union, unofficial. And that's where all of the things actually took place, okay? We don't like, as a culture, we expect to be able to leave our mark. We expect to be able to comment. And that's particularly true amongst Gen Z, okay? That actually just consuming is something which normally is not as good as being able to co-curate and to being able to shape. Flexibility is something which they hold to. And that's partly, again, because you can change your plans from morning to afternoon. But also, things like Etsy and even eBay are becoming significant forms of income for those who might be full-time students or who might be working elsewhere. And actually, one of the things I love about Gen Z is the fact that they're incredibly entrepreneurial. That many of them, if they are given a complex problem, are able to arrive at entrepreneurial solutions that are somewhat out of the box because that's how this technological formation has formed them. And then finally, informality, or what we might call authenticity. If you were writing to your boss 50 years ago, you'd have probably written them a letter, you'd have done it thoughtfully. You might have typed it and signed your name at the bottom. Today, if you were communicating with your boss, it's probably by the same medium that you would communicate with your best mate or your mum. Okay? You'll probably use WhatsApp or in a work context, perhaps something like Microsoft Teams or Slack, which means that the hierarchy of authority for Gen Z has largely collapsed. It's okay to write to your boss or your pastor in the same way that you would write to your best mate. And so it's fine to use emojis. It's fine to fine to send your pastor gifts. It's fine to write in non-complete. And now, I was speaking to a pastor, they said, they're so disrespectful. That's not the case, actually. Okay, it's that they prize informality over authenticity. And in a world in which we know it's only too easy for one thing to seem online different from what it actually is, more spontaneous, unpolished communication feels more real and trustworthy than a statement that comes by email, which has obviously been polished by a committee. This, by the way, is why the most popular YouTubers tend not to have beautiful shots anymore. Often it's just them speaking to their iPhone. And that's considered much more trustworthy and real and true than, you know, the kind of beautiful drone shots that my generation loves when we watch videos. Somebody said to me recently, actually, a shaky iPhone camera, that's absolutely fine. Bad sound quality is unforgivable, which may say something to you about your church comms. This does mean, I mean, I'm not going to go into this because we don't have time, but it means that increasingly when it comes to making sense of big issues, even around who I am and how I navigate something as significant as my sexuality, increasingly I will turn to YouTube to figure those things out rather than those who are close to me. I'm going to skip that. And we may return to it tomorrow. The other aspect I do want us to think about, though, before we finish is this. This graph I find so interesting. This is a percentage of waking hours in which somebody is surrounded by information. And you can see back in 1900, I honestly don't know how they figured this out. But in 1900, this reckons less than 10% of your time was spent being surrounded by information. A conversation with someone, perhaps, reading the newspaper, those sorts of things, less than 10%. By 2020, nearly 80% of our time, we were surrounded by information whilst we were awake. So you always have your GPS on as you drive. You always have the radio on, if you're a certain generation, or you're listening to Spotify if you're of a different generation. Okay? And so the amount of information that we've been surrounded by is increasing, and it's increasing incredibly quickly. Now, get this. We consume apparently 90 times the amount of information as in 1940, but four times more even than 2005. Okay? And the amount of information we consume, measured by bits, is increasing by around 5% every year. Now, all of us are swimming in lots of information, but this is the default for Gen Z. And it means that when it comes to responding to information, they react differently. Here is the average number of notifications per week by generation. So I don't know about those who are older than Gen X, but if you're Gen X, you receive one notification every 17 minutes. If you're a millennial, you receive a notification every 8 minutes, and it's the same for Gen Z. Okay, so the amount of notifications, pings, is increasing generationally, particularly from Gen X to millennials, and there we are. But look at this. Here is the average unread phone notifications by generation. Gen X, 49 notifications. If you're a millennial, 175. Gen Z, 11,289 unread phone notifications. And you wonder why the Gen Z in your church don't read the church email. And this is because actually Gen Z have found a way of responding to swimming in information, which I would suggest is more sophisticated, more nuanced, and perhaps leads to a better quality of life than those of us who are still figuring it out. Here are some of the side effects of digital immersion. One is a growing hunger for embodiment. So again, online, blah, 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 all of this about, they're constantly on social media, blah, 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 blah. Actually, talk to Gen Z in your church. Often they've got better ways of finding boundaries for things around social media and internet than you do. And one of the things that we're seeing is a growing hunger for embodiment. I spoke to a guy in my church this time last year. I said, what are you doing with your summer holiday? He said, I'm going dry stone walling in North Yorkshire. I'm going to hand in my phone. I'm going with my mates. We're all going to build dry stone walls together. It's great because my muscles ache at the end of the day. I can see a difference that I've made, and I don't even want to look at my phone for the whole day. Now, isn't that interesting? Part of, I think, what's going on with an increased desire, particularly for embodied forms of spirituality, is reacting against swimming in this digital current for the whole time. Secondly, there's a longing for a place in space, time, and story. If you're reading things online, it necessarily reduces what is unique to the person, the place, and the time that produced it. And so there's a really interesting way of, actually, my space, my time is important to me. And that's showing itself in a whole number of ways. One of them actually is around a surge in kind of old camera use, SDLR, or even older camera technology, where you can actually point and shoot and it's meaningful rather than just an image that you might never look again on your phone. And then thirdly, and this is where I'll leave us for today, an expressed desire for intergenerational mentoring. Now, I said to a student a couple of years ago, they were saying, I need wisdom. And this person wasn't a Christian, and I was doing a whole load of thinking about biblical wisdom thinking at that point. I said, how would you define wisdom? Do you know what the student said to me? This was brilliant. Wisdom is the things that you cannot learn from YouTube. That's very close, actually, to a biblical definition, that there is a certain grain that goes with just living in the world, which is embodied, which is storied, which you cannot learn simply from a distant digital mentor. You speak to Gen Z in your church, and nearly all of them will say, the thing that I long for is a mentor. They're very good relationships with their parents, by and large, Gen Z, partly because of WhatsApp. But the things they talk about with their parents are the things they talk about on WhatsApp, largely, which is, you know, family holidays, Fantasy Premier League, those sorts of things. They long for wisdom. Nearly everybody says, I want a mentor. Now, get this. As I've traveled around the UK, I have noticed that lots of other people, particularly the 55s and over, and say, do you know what, I look around at this generation, all I want to do is mentor them. I say, have you ever offered? And they say, oh, no, 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 no. And you say to the Gen Zs, have you ever asked any of these people to mentor you? Oh, no, 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 I never could. And that's because Gen Z lack confidence, but also the over 55s lack confidence as well. We think we're going to be, I'm not over 55, but the over 55s think they will be shamed because they don't know how to use TikTok. And I've said to some of these over the 55s, they are not wanting your mentoring on how to use TikTok. There is a wonderful God-given opportunity, both for formation and evangelistically, that is intergenerational. I'm going to finish there, and we'll pick up where we left off tomorrow. Let me pray for us today. Father, we thank you so much for each other. Father, Acts 17 says you work out the exact time and places in which your people dwell. And as we think about what that means for our nation, ethnically, culturally, but also generationally, none of this is an accident. And so, Father, we say, make us aware, make us ready to be used, to be hope sharers, not only with those in our own generation, but also those of other generations. Father, for the Gen Z who are here, I pray, please, that you would give them wisdom and mentors, that they actually would be able to shape the church as we increasingly get used to being hope sharers in this landscape. But Father, for the rest of us, help us to just take some of the headlines with a pinch of salt. I think this is a spectacular generation within the church, but they need prayer, they need wisdom, they need mentoring, they need encouragement, they need formation. Make us willing to play our part, I pray, in Jesus' name. Amen.